Hiya. For Lingua Franca, I'm Maria Zylstra with the third in this five-week season of our ABC Radio National Summer Series featuring Dr. Valerie Hanitiuk, the Director of the British Centre for Literary Translation at the University of East Anglia in England. As one of the star turns at the Literary Translation Festival and Summer School run by Monash University last year in the Wheeler Centre at the State Library of Victoria in Melbourne, Valerie Hanitiuk's lecture, Optical Illusions, Literary Translations as a Refractive Process, was the very stimulating keynote address. And I spoke with her about that, as well as other of her many projects, including the phenomenon of how literature can move from the context of a specific language or place into an uber category of world literature, in which case the original context of the work often just slips our mind. Isn't that so, Valerie?
Yeah, well, exactly. A lot of our foundational works are, in fact, or have, in fact, arisen from a translation process. And so it's odd that we tend to forget that. Occasionally, I'll have somebody, when I talk about my work in translation with, say, a taxi driver or something, and they'll say, oh, I don't know anything about translation. I said, well, have you ever read, you know, I don't tend to say War and Peace, but I might say The Story of Heidi. Do you ever read that to your children? Or do you read Murakami Haruki, the very contemporary Japanese author, or The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, that series of detective novels? I mean, these are translations, and people often forget that, and they need to be reminded.
Yeah, or even fairy stories like Perrault or Hans Christian Andersen, or
The Brothers Grimm,
Tove Janssen with her Mumintroll books.
Exactly, and I think sometimes it's very healthy, I think, to be reminded that the world is not a monolingual place and it's not a monocultural place. And we as human beings are, by definition of being human, constantly being translated and working with or struggling with means of communication from one person to another, because each of us comes from a different background, we'll bring different things to the table. So we're really translating our own experiences in any given conversation as well.
Yeah. Well, you liken translation to what happens to light when it passes from one medium to another. Can you just explain that, please?
Sure. Yeah, the lecture I gave in Melbourne was titled Optical Illusions, Literary Translation as a Refractive Process. And I took this metaphor or this image of refraction. And of course, if you remember your physics class in high school, refraction is when a light hits a prism and then is refracted or spread out into all of its constituent parts. For example, a rainbow will show the different colors all embedded within a white light. And my argument was that the white light or the original light is perhaps the original text, but when it hits the prism or the cultural interface, it then goes off into different directions depending on who is reading and translating it. And that explains why each translation of a given text will read very, very differently. It's not a negative thing. It's not showing that the translators are falling down on the job or are failing or are no good at their work. It simply means that within any given text is the possibility of many possible texts, many different readings and interpretations.
That's such a great metaphor for how a piece of literature can change when it's translated and, as you've described, it becomes different. It allows for distortions and mirages and obliquenesses or slants, and that's less constrictive than the usual notion of the process of translation, you know, which is usually to do with what's correct or more correct or less correct. Well, is it right? Is this word exactly?
Yeah, I always think it's quite unfortunate to limit discussions of literary translation to the very flat dichotomies of literal versus free, or good versus bad, true versus false, faithful versus betrayal, because really it is much more complicated than that. And these obliqueness, of course, as light refracts, it goes obliquely, if you will, or at a slant. That slant offers new interpretations and new creativity and adds value to the process. I think of literary translation very much as a value-added act. And these metaphors help us understand the process in a way that other forms of discussion often simply don't take us to those kind of new insights into the process. I've done quite a bit of work about translation or metaphors for the translation process. And one of my favorites, although I don't think we have time to discuss it here, is one that Europeans came up with to try and discuss translation from the Japanese in the early encounter between Europe and Japan. And they called the process, they likened it to the squeezing of a jellyfish, that it is so amorphous and difficult to grasp, and it begins as beautiful, but when you try to translate it, you squeeze all of the beauty and life out of it. And I thought that metaphor was absolutely striking and bizarre, much too negative for my purposes, but very fascinating in that somebody would conceive of translation in that way.
Well, if we just keep the simile in mind of, refraction and how it might, as a process, apply to translation. I'd like to ask you about a collection of translated stories that's just been published and that you're involved in called One Step Towards the Sun. And those stories were written during the 20th century by women from the state of Orissa in India in the regional language of Oriya. And that's very unusual to come across stories from that language. So could you just tell a little bit about how it came into being before we talk about how the idea of refraction might apply to this translation?
Sure. Yeah, this is a very exciting new project for me. I actually came to translation studies through an interest in women's writing. So when my colleague in India, my colleague Supriya Kaur, approached me and asked me to work with her on editing this collection of short stories by women from her native province, I just leapt at the chance. One problem with the world of literary translation, especially into English, it doesn't necessarily work the other direction, but certainly into English, is we don't have enough of it. We don't read enough international literature because publishers often don't believe that readers want it. They're afraid to advertise texts as translations because they think readers will think perhaps it's too high literature or too off-putting or too foreign. And so there's this reluctance by publishing houses and many other members of the profession of, or the literary profession, if you will, to have translations out there. And so I always consider it one of my great missions in life to try and coax various translations into being, help them find readers. Because I really believe that readers don't care if a text is translated or not. What they really want is to read good books. And these are amazing stories written over a period of 50, 60 years by women in a part of the world that we know very little about. And yet they're talking about so many issues that are either very similar to the issues that we may be dealing with here in the U.S. or there in Australia. And yet, from a particularly refractive viewpoint, their own viewpoint within their own cultural milieu.
Mm. They're all written originally in Oriya?
Most of them are. A couple of the stories were actually written in Bengal or Bangla, as it is more commonly known today, because that's a fairly strong minority language within the region. But most of the stories were written in Oriya, that's correct.
And that language, the language of Orissa, Oriya, has a documented history of 3 millennia, and its literature dates from the 8th century.
Exactly, and so that should strike readers, I think, as a very significant fact that the literature has been around for many, many centuries, and yet we know virtually none of it. And really, translation into English of this literature didn't really begin, or isn't said to begin, until the 1940s. So that's quite a striking discrepancy between the time the literature has been circulating and developing and been enjoyed by people in that province, in that particular part of the world, and the very few decades in which the rest of the world has had access to it through the medium of translation.
It might make people think, though, that it's too terribly obscure and ancient or too very different culturally from what people might be able to get a clue in. Who read it that older literature, or that tradition of literature, who was it written for and who read it?
Well, obviously there are issues, cultural issues of education and caste and status and those sort of things that come into play anytime you're trying to talk about literature of different regions. And so the literature itself would be, of course, written by those who had access to education and access to writing, which often didn't include women. So women didn't start writing until much later than men did, for example. However, who read it? I prefer to ask the question who received it, who enjoyed it. Much of the literature of any part of the world is actually told first, even if it's written down, but it circulates in the form of orature or oral storytelling. These stories would be read to people who could enjoy it whether or not they were literate, and I think that's a very key fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, in comparison with that tradition then, who's the audience for these newer stories? Now, in English, is it an audience within India or an audience internationally? Perhaps you'll say both, but perhaps
I will certainly say both, and I'd like to explain why for a moment. There's really two different branches of Indian literature in the English language. You first have a branch of Indian literature that's written in English. You might think of Salman Rushdie, for example, or who are quite well known in English, and they write their
Vikram
text.
Seth or Arundhati Roy.
Exactly. And they write their text in English for a world market. But you also have Indian literature that is circulating in English that began its life in another language, in one of the native languages, and of course there are many in India, and has been translated and circulates through that medium.
Because English is a lingua franca in India.
Exactly. And they circulate in English not only for the international market, but also for the market within India. Of course, with all of these different languages in the country, Indians if one wants to speak in stereotypes, are incredibly linguistically gifted. They do tend to have several languages, but they would not all necessarily be able to read Oriya. And yet, if the texts are translated into English, people who are Hindi speakers or Bangla speakers or speakers of any of the other languages have access to part of the national heritage, the fuller national heritage of India.
Mm.
So who is the book marketed to, if you will, these English translations? Well, to people within India, as well as, I would hope, people from around the world who want to read these stories written by women talking about their lives. And I'd like to, if I may, just jump back for a moment. You did say that some people might approach a book like this and think, oh, that's too foreign, it's too distant from my experience. But when we look at these stories and we look at the themes that they develop, they're about women's lives. They're about family. They're about education. They're about politics. They're about the environment. They're about sexuality. They're about friendship. They're about religion. They're about all of the same things that exercise us in whatever part of the world we're in. And yet they're told from a particular context. So we have access to them because of that familiarity of theme and humanity. And yet we find something new and exciting because they are very different and very unlike us and our experience in other ways.
On the phone from Harvard University in the States, where she was located as a visiting scholar temporarily last year, Valerie Hanitayuk, a co-editor of the collection of stories from the Indian state of Orissa, translated into English under the title One Step Towards the Sun, bringing them towards the light of a greater readership in a newly refracted showing. For the publication details, go to the Lingua Franca website at abc.net.au/rn/Lingua Franca. I'm Maria Zylstra. Till next week then, doo!